Welcome to the Senate Committee on Consumer Protection and Public Affairs. Today is Thursday, March 12, 2009. We are going to start with the public hearings. Senator Atkinson is here with his constituent. We'll hear those bills first, and then I understand that at least a couple of my committee members need to leave. We'll do as much as we can until then, but we will start by opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 467. Lori, could you please explain Senate Bill 467 for us?
We'll have Senator Atkinson come up.
I would be happy to. Senate Bill 467 prohibits local government from applying approval criteria to a single-family dwelling with five or fewer roomer accommodations that is different than approval criteria applied to single-family dwelling with no roomer accommodations. It defines approval criteria to include zoning requirements, use permits, property tax classifications, and assorted things as listed in the bill.
Thank you very much. And we're going to start with Senator Atkinson. And are you going to bring Mr. Earl up with you?
Yeah, I'll go first.
Okay. Sure. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And members of the committee, for the record, Jason Atkinson. I represent Southern Oregon in the state Senate. I will have my comments allude to both bills, if that's all right, Madam Chair. Essentially, it's the same issue.
All right.
And the issue is, if I could just give a couple-minute background and then why we're here. The issue revolves around renting of rooms. Can you rent a room? Seems to be fairly straightforward. Can you rent a room in the city of Corvallis? Can you rent a room in Monmouth? Can you rent a room in LeGrand? Can you rent a room in Portland? Can you rent a room in Ashland? And the answer in all of those municipalities is certainly, of course you can. Rooms are often rented in single dwelling units for a very simple reason, which is either college students or, in some cases, people need a place to live. Those rooms vary in size and direction, but simply the policy for us here is, can you rent a room? I got involved in the particular case of which you're going to hear about a year and a half ago. It was actually in 2007 when one municipality said that, no, you cannot rent a room. And they got into a lot of minutiae regarding what is a lodging house and what is a boarding house, two different pieces of language that come clearly from the 1930s when we had the Depression and we actually had things that were boarding houses and we had things that were called lodging houses. This particular municipality has hung themselves all over this phrase and simply said that, no, you cannot without going through conditional use permits and all the rest. Why this becomes a statewide policy is very simply, if you apply that type of mentality statewide, you have all of a sudden said that there's a whole litany of citizens that are living in all of those municipalities that I just listed off illegally. If you recall, just to go quickly, last year in the February special session, I had a minority report that dealt with this. Many of you probably recall the issue. Now, being a minority report, even though I have passed one minority report, the minority report did not pass. Senator Burdick, thank you for coming. But you will remember that in the side of the minority report, there was the issue, can you rent a room? And while even the majority party was sympathetic to the cause, given the fact that we were only in session for less than 30 days, the bill did not move forward. You will also recall, colleagues who were here, that the Department of Housing came to every one of us and asked us to approve a measure that would change, would allow them certain privileges when it came to low-income housing. I don't know if you remember that in the February session, but they all came to us. They had a full court press to ask the Oregon State Senate to allow them, if I recall correctly, sponsor legislation that would enable them to go after other federal dollars and loosen up the strings as it would relate to low-income housing. As it would put to us, all as senators, both Republicans and Democrats from the Department of Housing, a very emotional argument for us to approve that bill. At that time, before we voted on the bill, I asked for their help with this particular issue, given that the particular residence that was called into question is actually not for college students, but people who are low income, that the city, this particular city in Southern Oregon, is essentially hassling. And the Department of Housing made all kinds of things to me, saying, yes, we will help, yes, we'll be there, yes, we'll help iron this out. And as is the case, oftentimes, with those of us that have served for a long time, will know that as soon as the vote was taken, the Department of Housing evaporated, and I even doubt whether or not they're here today. Their failure on this issue has been total, it has been complete, and I have lost faith in the Department of Housing over their giving me lip service during the February special session, and all of you who are paying a particular attention to the issue then, and then dropping the ball. If you move now, if you recall, this bill, both of these bills, simply says that it is legal, and it sets out a statewide policy that says you can rent a room. In fact, one of them has up to 5 rooms you can rent. And it gets rid of the antiquated language, which is boarding houses and lodging houses, for a specific reason. The reason is to say that those who live this way now, or live in this type of manner, whether they be someone who is low income or whether they be a college student, it says it's legal. And we're not going to have one particular municipality hassling somebody over antiquated language. It also tells the Department of Housing that this is legal and to pursue these types of options when it comes to affordable housing, an option I'm sure across the board, Republican and Democrat, we would all support. Now, the issue comes before you then, should we have a statewide policy when we have one municipality that's essentially doing something that some people might find offensive. I would just remind you that it was the good Senator Przanski who brought to us the issue of the Coburg Police Department who was writing checks or writing tickets. Those of you probably recall that issue where the Coburg Police Department was going up, and I think it was on I-5, writing tickets to people just because they could. And if you were here then, or I believe all of us were here, even in the House, you remember voting on that particular issue, which is, as a statewide policy, we will not allow a municipality to do this type of behavior. That is simply what these two Senate bills also seek to do when it comes to the very simple issue, which is renting a room. So I've touched very briefly on lodging house and boarding house, but there is tremendous ambiguity in the law and depends on who you're asking and who your attorney is as to whether or not a piece of property falls into both of these antiquated phrases. Let me read to you what a lodging house is, quote, any building or portion thereof containing not more than 5 guest rooms where rent is paid in money, goods, labor, or otherwise, which is a nice way of saying you can work off your rent. Now, if you remember from the 1930s, that was a very popular phrase. A boarding house, conversely, is defined or referenced in either the Oregon Structural Specialty Code or the Oregon Dwelling Specialty Code in use at the time. In 07, the Structural Specialty Code defines a boarding house as, quote, a building arranged or used for lodging for compensation with or without meals and not occupied as a single family unit. Now, if you can tell me the difference in both of those, I think you would get the legal prize of the day. But I will also notice when I started looking at this, I asked the building codes department if they had any problem with my bill, and they do not. In fact, tightening up and cleaning up the language and getting rid of the antiquated language would be very helpful. I would like to bring up the constituent who has brought all this to a boil. I think you'll find his testimony interesting and compelling. But the larger point for all of us to consider is statewide, should we allow people to rent rooms? And given the economic times, does it make sense? And I would urge you that, yes, it does. And I very much appreciate the indulgence of the chair for hearing both these bills. And I realize you've done a courtesy to me, and I do appreciate that. But I will say that there is a larger policy issue here that I would like to address. Sometimes it does take a long time. This is almost 2 years of harping on this issue. But I think I've figured out a way just to make it fit and make it so that a whole range of Oregonians are not living illegally. Let me conclude my remarks and take any questions you might have, and then I'll bring up Mr. Earle.
Thank you, Senator. I just wanted to clarify, when you read the definition, you were reading from the structural specialty code? Is that what you
yes.
said?
I'm actually reading from a letter from the city of Medford. The Oregon structural specialty code. And again, the reason for me reading both definitions of a lodging house and a boarding house is that if you look at the statutes, they're used interchangeably. And then, if you wanted to be difficult to somebody, which in this particular case, I believe is happening, you have people that are splitting hairs over the difference between a lodging house and a boarding house, and I would suggest to the committee that it's better policy for us just to take those antiquated terms and say, yes, you can rent a room. It's much simpler, cleaner, rather than going through trying to define 1930s legal terms.
Thank you, Senator. Committee, any questions for Senator Atkinson? Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you. Allow me to bring up Mr. Earle, and I'll help him.
Welcome, and if you'll please start by stating your name for the record.
Hello there. My name's Bill Earle, and I live in Jacksonville, the Rogue Valley. I've been a resident down there since 1969, and I've been pretty much a builder most all those years. I served on the Medford Planning Commission and different various committees and architectural committees and so on. And I've always been somewhat of a proponent for small homes and affordability, even before it was, kind of a buzzword. So I've built a lot of little houses, I've built hundreds of homes and so on. Well, several years ago, I had an idea about working with an area of our city that had some kind of a rundown area, I'd say. And I thought, what can you do without going out, because I'm a very small builder, and doing a major land development or something like that? What can you do with what we already have and maybe try to meet some of those housing needs? And so much is done by organizations and committees over the years where they build a home for the Habitat and that type of thing, but it really doesn't put a dent into the needs. Also, my young children were both back and forth to college and such, and I ended up building a home that created a little apartment with a home. Well, over the years, my kids came and went, their friends came and went, just different people and different needs, and I saw, wow, there's quite a need for this type of housing, something that is affordable as well as, as a minimal starting point. And it's the minimal bar, I call it raising the bar or lowering the bar, but if our minimal standard for housing, typically we would say a one-bedroom dwelling. So I thought, well, how could you be possibly lower than that? Well, it's basically a room, because that's what I provided for my kids and these different ones over the period of time. And I saw that there was quite a need for, the privacy that you get from having a room and also not having to go into partnership or share with others and stuff. So I started to look into the building codes locally and to see if I had any conflict with it. And, of course, I didn't come up with any conflict. And I checked also with a couple of different people that I knew on a first-name basis in the planning departments to see if they saw any conflict with the concept of, basically having a room available for rent. And they said there was no conflict. So I didn't pursue any further, nor did I get that information in writing. And in retrospect, I wish I had, because it's come back to haunt me. In about 2003, and this has been going on ever since, I used to have a full head of hair about that time, it's just been a continual battle, because what took place is that I bought a very small house, 800 square feet, two-bedroom home in a section of the city that I felt was, ripe for upgrading and renewal, and a lot configuration such that I could add a four-bedroom addition, which I did. So basically what I had is a single-family dwelling and added a four-bedroom addition to that dwelling is the way I see it. When I went to get my permits and such, they came back with language saying, well, this isn't going to be a foster care. It was because of the nature of the design of the building. It says, well, it won't be a foster care or any other kind of assisted living. I said, no, it would not. Well, they put an imposition on the building permit that said that any condition or any final building approval would be subject to me signing something saying that I was not adding any dwelling units. Well, I knew I was not adding dwelling units, and that's where we get into a bunch of technical things between what is a dwelling unit and what is a bedroom unit. But a dwelling unit contains a bathroom, or a kitchen, excuse me. So I had not added any new kitchens, no dwelling units. I didn't have a problem signing that. Anyway, I built it, and during the course of construction, what had happened is I understood that the engineering department that collects SDC charges just really had a problem with this because they kept saying, well, what is this, an apartment or something? And because it now became a six-bedroom house, they thought that was out of the ordinary, even though it was only a couple thousand square foot total. But I did everything the way you're supposed to. I knew all the kinds of issues with upgrading something and new parking areas and sidewalks and landscaping and all modernization of the existing building as well as the new construction because I wanted to do something very nice. But all the way through the process, they kept challenging it and had people from different departments challenge me. And they even sent the building inspector coming to me saying, you've added apartments here. And all they are is just very simple, one room, one bedroom rooms. That's all they are. So he responded back to the Public Works and such that, no, I had not added dwelling units. So we tried to put out that fire with all that. But through the process, I just had a lot of conflict and aggravation, and it really came down to SDC charges. They didn't really know what to call this. Well, shortly after I had completed the property, it got challenged again, and it went through building and also to planning. In both cases, I was told verbally that I had not violated any codes and was totally in compliance. I didn't realize at that time that the information I got was basically policy and had been policy for years and was not code. Because the code didn't say, no, you cannot rent a room, certain individuals in the different departments were saying, because we don't tell you you can rent a room, then therefore you cannot rent a room. It comes back to what the senator was saying about lodging houses and boarding houses and such. I had done a lot of homework, and I started really digging the homework, because in the meantime, I'd sold the property, and now the new owner was questioning what I had sold her. You know, I sold her with the idea that you could rent a room. Well, that started this whole chain of events, in which case the senator became aware of it, and he really came to my aid. And I really, I'm not much into politics or anything, but I didn't realize someone could come on a personal level to that degree. But I think he also saw the same things I had been seeing, and that is that we try to build a habitat, you know, house for the habitat, and you put one little family in it. I think the city of Ashland at that time said that they were like 1,800 housing units short fulfilling the workforce housing need at that time, 5 years ago. Yeah, there's this need for these young people getting started and people that are maybe set back financially or have been divorced or whatever, from the youngest to the oldest. And so this is the way I felt could really address that, because we have an inventory of existing homes, and yet we have maybe a lady's lost her husband, so opened up another room, the kids have grown up, they've moved off, and so we already had this opportunity. We didn't need to create new housing. It fit all the, I thought I'm on all the right buzzwords, politically correct, with the idea of urbanization, better use of utilization of utilities and infrastructure and such, and yet, because of these doggone SDC charges, I think it started the battle, and the city dug in their heels. The fellow that had been on the planning department as a senior planner had retired and become a private planner. He had been the very person I had contacted when this came to a head prior to me selling the property. So he went to bat for me. I actually hired him at that point to go and talk to the city about this. Well, they practically almost called him a liar along with me. When the fact is we had no evidence or documentation that we'd had these conversations about it being an approved use. And they said, well, we don't care what policy's been in the past. It's not an approved use. And what it is now, it's a boarding house. So this comes to the really key point here, and it's such a hard thing to really kind of sink your teeth into. But the codes I don't argue with. I've researched these things to midnight hours on many, many occasions. But we have codes that basically refer to boarding houses and lodging houses, and I think they're in there for a legitimate reason. But there's confusion within our state-adopted codes, and then when the cities go to adopt their own language, they either add a word or leave out a word, I don't think necessarily on purpose, sometimes by accident, but it changes the whole flavor of the thing. The city said that a boarding house is any building that has a room for rent in it. But if you read the state codes and stuff, it says any building and not occupies a single family dwelling. So the state had distinguished the fact that if you had a home and occupied as a single family dwelling, then you could have up to five additional rooms available for rent. I don't argue that. I think it's legitimate. And the same kind of language comes down to the lodging house argument. The city took the position, among some very heated arguments that we had directly in the presence of the mayor and the city attorney and so on, that no, you could not even rent a single room. And if you were to rent a single room, the option you had is to label it a boarding house. They didn't even use the lodging house term then. Label it a boarding house, apply for a conditional use permit, which is a couple $1,000 when you hire a planner and pay the city fees. Then you go to a public hearing, which you may or may not be approved for. If you are approved, then your property turns into a commercial venture, and you will pay SDC charges, which amount to about $10,000 in my case. All that. And they didn't make a distinction between one room or five rooms. If you rented one room, and that's where the senator, I think, really stepped into this and realizing that is totally inappropriate. In the meantime, because I've hired other people to help me, code people and such, the city is starting to back down from some of these positions. It became newsworthy in the paper and so on. So now they go in there and they mess with it again now. What they've done now is to say, okay, well, we never said that. You can rent a room. But you can't rent two rooms. If you rent two rooms, then you have to have the owner occupy the property. But if you rent more than two rooms and the owner isn't occupying, then we're going to go back to labeling a boarding house and lodging house. And I just think, as the senator's requesting here, that on a statewide level, that needs to be cleared up. And I think that also in our days of our economic difficulties and such, these are the very things that whole committees, I've sat on these housing committees, and I've sat there where it goes round and around and around. I'm sure you guys have sat on such committees too, and nothing comes of it. And I'm saying it's right there in front of us. All we have to do is clarify the code. We don't have to write new codes. We don't have to reinvent anything. But let's, as the senator said, some of this language goes back to who knows when. I'd like to meet the first people that wrote it. But I do recognize that back to this distinction between building and dwelling. I think you really have to look at that very closely, because technically you could go out, and I bet you don't even realize this, you could go out and build a building. You could have five or six or eight or however many little rooms you want in it, and you could rent that out, and it could be called a boarding house. Now, yes, that has a conditional use, or it has to be in a proper zoning, but it doesn't have to be a dwelling because it does not have to contain a kitchen. If you think about it, that's pretty odd. It doesn't even have to have a bathroom. You could rent a room without a bathroom. And so when you look at it that way, you say, well, there is a thing. If someone's going to go build a building and call it, you know, and just put these rooms, yeah, well, we're going to have to call it something. It's not a single-family dwelling. It has become a building with rooms for rent. But in the case where a building is probably, in this case, in the old history of this thing, a home was modified to allow a rental room or such, that's why they put the provisions in there, and we keep coming back to this five rooms or less. Because somewhere along the line, this code was meant to have some control over someone having sprawling properties and such.
Mr. Earl, can I ask you, I'm sorry to do this, but we're going to lose some of our committee soon, and I want to give them an opportunity to ask you some questions.
Okay.
If you have any final remarks you can make, and I want to make sure we have a chance to talk to you about questions.
I didn't want to approach this with the idea, let's change building codes, because we've adopted a building code that's adopted even in other states. What the senator's trying to do is make sure that this thing is universal statewide and is not discouraged from one town to the next. And give some clear direction and incentive, not only for property owners to feel that they're comfortable in renting these rooms, but also someone who may be willing to go out and step out and improve some properties or something. You know, I was asked, one of the task forces says, why don't we make it mandatory that a builder, every 10th house he builds one of these? I said, that's not right. You've got to make it commercially viable. And whether it's the widow renting out a room and needs the extra income, she isn't doing it just because it's fun. It's economically practical. And that's what I'm hoping, but unfortunately, as you can probably hear from this, it's not so simple and clear.
Thank you for your testimony. Senator George?
Mr. Earl, I want to tell you how much I appreciate you taking your time and being innovative and finding solutions to community problems. And I just want to let you know how important I think what you're doing is. My great-grandmother, George, rented out a room to a young 19-year-old woman who is now my grandmother. And that's how my family, she was from Texas, and she came out to California right after the Depression and rented a room for my great-grandmother, and that's how my grandmother met my father's family. And so this was a type of living that happened that was very important through our history. And I want to tell you that I really appreciate you putting your own capital and getting creative and finding solutions to a community problem like this. And I'm looking forward to us finding a solution for you, and I just want to make sure I put that on the record. I appreciate your efforts on this, and putting your own capital into it is even better without asking for any kind of public support, and I really do appreciate that.
Well, thank you for that.
Thank you, Senator. Questions, Senator?
Yeah, I have three technical questions. The first one is, the rooms that you built did not have kitchens and bathrooms, is that correct?
They did not have kitchens.
But they had their individual bathrooms.
Yes, sir.
Okay, and the second one would be, they're not owner-occupied? I mean, you weren't the owner that occupied the...
I did not.
Okay. I think those are the three questions I wanted to answer.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Earle? No, thank you very much. I want to also thank you for taking the time to come up here and tell your story, and also for your efforts to make the community a better place. So
thank you very much.
And we have next we have Patrick Allen, please. Welcome, and if you'll please state your name for the record and give us your testimony. Thank you.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Members of the committee, Patrick Allen. I'm the Deputy Administrator of the Building Codes Division at the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Just quickly, you heard a lot of testimony about a lot of different definitions and a lot of different parts of code and law and local regulations go by. Our belief is that the bill lines up with the way we approach regulating the issue of what design standards, what building safety standards do residential structures need to meet if rooms are being rented out. If it's five and fewer rooms, then it falls under the residential structures code. Now, there are a number of things when a jurisdiction hands out permits. It hands out a variety of different kinds of permits when it allows an activity, and so things that went by regarding conditional use permits or systems development charges or those kinds of things aren't anything that we regulate under our code. We think our code, though, deals with this issue with five and fewer rooms. The one piece of the bill that we would want to talk about if you wanted to move forward with this or a concept like it is that this creates an additional statutory definition of single-family dwelling, and we want to make sure that we didn't set a landmine out there for somebody later not knowing that there was a definition that is potentially different from definitions that we would use in the future in the code or those kinds of things. But other than that, this bill really is consistent with the way we, from a building code standpoint, approach the building safety standards that you have to meet to rent out rooms.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Mr. Allen? Yes, Senator George.
When I was down at Oregon State, a big group of us would get together and go find a five-bedroom house, and we would all pool our dollars and rent that house. And one person was usually the money manager, and we would all give that money to our buddy who was better at keeping dollars than the rest of us, and we would pool our dollars and then pay the landlord for that. And to me, it doesn't seem like this is that much different than that scenario or that situation.
Well, from a building code standpoint, Senator George, Chair Bonamici, there's not an owner occupancy element to the building code standard. It's the number of rooms, and is it a building being used as a residential structure? There is a set of codes related to boarding houses, but those are larger structures built or renovated for a purpose of boarding. That do have a different set of risks and requirements and those kinds of things. But in that scenario that you described, if the issue is, well, you know, gee, there wasn't an owner-occupant, that's nothing that would enter into a code discussion, as I understand it.
I'm sure you were the one, Senator George, who took care of all the finances.
I'm not good at the details. How's that?
Are there any other questions for Mr. Allen? I just wanted to clarify that we were talking about two different parts of the building code. If you want to tell me again what those were, the structural part and then the...
Well, there's the structural code and then there's the residential structural code. And the way it works is that in the structural code, which applies to larger and commercial structures and those kinds of things, this is detached lodging houses is defined as five and fewer units, and it by definition is relegated to the residential structures code for the regulatory standards that it needs to meet.
Thank you very much. Any other questions, Mr. Allen? Thank you for your testimony. Thanks. And next we have Cindy Robert and John Adam, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Robert, and I'm proud to represent the city of Medford. First of all, I apologize that this local problem has had to come before you, not once, but twice, to this legislative body. I don't think it's actually appropriate, and I wish that we had solved it before it got this far. And I want you to know that the local remedy that has always been available is currently underway. Be assured of that. 2 points I want to make on Mr. Earle's issue before John Adam, our planner from the city of Medford, speaks. First point is that this issue has been handled per Medford city ordinances. In 2003, Mr. Earle received a building permit for his addition, and his addition is for 4 rooms to 2 already. That equals 6, and we keep talking about 5 or less. Just to assure you that we're talking about 6 rooms in the building, not 5. And Mr. Earle received this building permit, and when he received it, the statement that he referred to that he signed said, detached two-story addition will be 4 bedrooms and 4 bathrooms attached by new breezeway from house, not foster care or treatment facility, just single-family resident for 1 family per owner slash builder. Building department to issue a certificate for occupancy stating for single family use only, no rental units. Mr. Earle signed that document. Since then, he's been trying to change the situation via legal arguments, changes in definitions, conversations about unfair applicability, getting Senator Atkinson got involved. Yet the solution, which is a conditional use permit, has been available to him all along, and he just started taking care of it from that end this past fall. Our planning commission is ready to talk to him and have a hearing, which is required, to deal with that conditional use permit, but he has delayed that meeting 3 times now with continuances. My second point is that, again, we're progressing towards a decision, not only on his conditional use permit, but we have, in fact, in the city of Medford, changed our language regarding boarding houses and their restrictions to meet the needs that have been brought up by Mr. Earle and have been really good points. We have changed the definitions so that we are no longer viewing 1 and 2 bedrooms being rented as a boarding house. 6, different story. Finally, let me just say that this kind of local government zoning is allowed for in both our Constitution and the Oregon statutes. It is not good for it to be one town to the next, as Mr. Earle says. It is good for it to be one town to the next. Mr. Earle thought that maybe it'd be better if everyone was the same. The whole point is for your local decision makers to decide about zoning based on your neighborhoods, your needs, to ensure that your neighborhood stays intact, to assure that the house next door does not become a quasi-fraternity with 6, 7, 8 men living in it, if that's not what you bought into. Mr. Earle knew how the house was zoned when he bought it. He knew what the permit allowed when he built onto it. We empathize with the situation. In November, an application for conditional use permit was finally forwarded that we're going to improve. We're going to be able to move forward, even though the house isn't his anymore. We will be able to move forward. And this is a local decision, and we're taking care of it, and it should not be taken care of here.
Thank you for your testimony. And Mr. Adam, please.
Yes, John Adam. I work for the city of Medford in the planning department. I'd like to echo everything that Cindy said and really just say that statewide impact is the issue. And I'm not speaking just from the perspective of Medford. I'm talking about the perspective from other cities in the whole state. Because, starting out with, in Medford, there is no prohibition on boarding houses. And as Cindy mentioned, 1 and 2 bedroom boarding houses are just allowed by right, no review process anymore. And we made that change because the questions were asked, because Mr. Earle raised the issues, and we responded to them and made the change in our code last year. He had a valid point, and there was something that, you know, he brought to our attention, something we were not aware of in our own code, because it was just anything where you rented a room was by definition a boarding house. Now the case is, if it's 3 to 5 bedrooms, there is a review process for it, and that's what Mr. Earle has applied for on behalf of the current property owner. And, you know, certainly City of Medford is not opposed to boarding houses or to affordable housing. And Mr. Earle does have a history of providing affordable housing in the community, and we recognize that. But each city has its own tolerances. every neighborhood has its own tolerances. And where what I see in the bill is a blanket allowance for boarding houses without any sort of review process. And apparently, no matter what the zoning district is. Now, not every zoning district can handle a boarding house because of the character of the neighborhood. And each city makes that choice. It knows its limits of tolerances. I'm not going to really touch on the SDC issue because that's not my area of expertise, but the whole purpose of SDCs, I'm not going to talk about whether, you know, it's too much or it's too little on the SDCs, but the whole reason that SDCs are in place is that it's a level playing field. It's so that developers and the city both know what to expect when they're going into a development situation. The city knows what to expect in terms of revenue. The developers know that there will not be unequal exactions put on them because it's in the books. It says this is what you'll be charged for having these sorts of impacts on the system. So I just wanted to say, with regard to the whole bill, yes, it is a statewide impact issue, and one size does not fit all.
Thank you very much. And before questions, I wondered if you could please, you said you did respond and change the definitions. I wonder if you'd be willing to share those with the committee, either by email or if you could submit those.
Madam Chair, I'll copy your mind out about ordinances
and
send them over to you.
Questions? Senator George.
Mr. Adam, let's say, for instance, we have four people who work in the tourism industry in Medford, mm-hmm. a big tourism industry, and the four individuals are not related, and they find a four- or five-bedroom house, and they decide that they're going to get together and rent that house. And so the four of them, all on minimum wage, realize that together they can pay the $900 rent or $1,000 rent, and so they come together and they rent the house, and they all four pay into something and pay the landlord. Mm-hmm. As I understand what you're saying, they would have to apply for a conditional use permit to do so.
No. If what has to happen is that the property owner has to get the conditional use permit for the property to rent it out. It's not relevant to who the individuals are. It's relevant to where what the zoning is, and where the house is located and what it's going to be used for. In some cases, and the city knows this, people are renting out several rooms, and, you know, we're not aware of it. And unless we get a complaint of some sort from, you know, noise, traffic, parking, you know, there's too many factors or too many things going on that are really disrupting the neighborhood, city usually is not going to go out and look for these problems.
But I'm trying to follow up.
Please.
But I'm right. I'm correct. And the way the city has interpreted your comp plan or your planning ordinance is that under that scenario, a landlord finds an individual comes to a landlord and says, "I want to rent your 4-bedroom house, and you're asking for $1,000 for a 5-bedroom house."
Mm-hmm.
And you say, "Fine, there's 5 bedrooms there, only one kitchen."
Yes.
And I find 5 friends who all want a kitchen, $200, and it's a great way to have low income housing. That would violate your ordinance, and the landlord would then be liable to ask for a conditional use permit. And I find that to be a very onerous process for, in essence, what's been a very common practice in this country since the beginning of this country. I mean, I can't even believe that we got to the point where friends can't get together and rent a house without going through a conditional use permit process.
Madam Chair, Senator George, you bring up a good conversation, and it's an interesting situation, but let me bring you back to reality a little bit, at least in this situation. We're talking about 6 rooms. We're talking about a neighborhood of small houses where you have 6 new cars parked on the street now. You have 6 more people using the sewage system. You have 6 more people impacting the traffic. That's the difference, and that where you live, it would be okay if those guys got together and rented the house across the street, which I believe has 13 rooms, the house across the street from you, but that would be okay for your system to be able to absorb. For some neighborhoods, that's not easy to absorb, and that's what the zoning requirements take into account, and that's why it has to be made on a case-by-case, local level.
Madam Chair, follow up?
Please.
But here lies your problem. Okay, so let's say, for instance, a family moves in who has 6 teenagers. Okay? Mm-hmm. One family has 16 teenagers. Or let's say, for instance, a family moves in who is a foster family who takes in a lot of kids, and they have, maybe they have two kids per bedroom in the residential zone, and maybe you have five of them who are drivers. That would have the exact same impact. It's just what you're basically doing is differentiating between, I mean, what I don't get is you're differentiating between, you say impact, but I can see a single family situation having actually a bigger impact than friends getting together and renting a room. I mean, that's the problem. It's practically the application would be applied differently.
Madam Chair, Senator George, a single-family dwelling is, in fact, already described and defined in both state law and in building codes. And so single-family, one family living there, you know, it's interesting. We got a statement from the Building Codes Division talking about how having several different people living in one house who don't congregate together, who are doing their own things, is actually more of a fire hazard. I know it seems wrong. I know you come from a family of lots of kids. You could have had that many cars parked on your street. But this is being done as a business. He was not living in the house. This was a business. Low income, albeit wonderful. Great that he does that, but it's a business. It was a business being run in his house. It was not him living there with his children. And furthermore, as John Adams said, we do not go out looking all over the city for these kind of violations. This came to our attention because Mr. Earl sold his house to a woman who then subsequently wanted to sell it again and was upset that what she was told could be done in her zone could not be done. It could not be done. It's the only reason this came to our attention. She came to the city and said, I need a note that says I can use this as a boarding house. And we said, whoa. We did not come after Bill Earl because he was doing it. We were asked for a letter by a subsequent owner.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Dredd.
Sorry, I was just out for a moment. The problem I have, and I agree with some, I sat on city council, so I understand zoning codes and whatever, but demanding an application for a conditional use permit, and I know that any conditional use permit can be denied. So there's no, you know, there's no standards given so that you would have to approve a conditional use permit. So I think your codes should be clearly defined as to what it would require for what he wants to build to be within the city. You know, and I know you have medium density, high density, and that sort of thing, but his case aside, if you had a house and you had extra rooms and you wanted to rent them out, that, you know, that needs to be clearly defined as well. And I don't think it sounds like your codes are not that way, and especially if you demand a conditional use permit.
Madam Chair, Senator Gerard, perhaps you're out of the room at the time. Those are good points, and Mr. Earl brought those to our attention, and we have cleaned up the code since then. We have worked hard to make sure it's clear on what you can and can't do.
Thank you very much. Further questions? Thank you very much for your testimony. I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 467 and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 471. We have some of the same people signed up. I'm going to have Lori do a brief summary of this, but we have some additional people as well. So I'm going to have Lori do a summary of this bill, and we'll try to at least get some of this before we lose more of our committee members.
Senate Bill 471, Madam Chair and members of the committee, prohibits the state or local government from discriminating against a homeowner by requiring the homeowner to obtain a permit for rental of a room in a single family dwelling having six or fewer bedrooms. It allows the Commissioner of the Bureau of Labor and Industries to appoint only administrative law judges to special tribunals or as a hearing officer for a contested case proceeding.
Thank you very much. And Senator Atkinson and Mr. Earl, did you want to add anything particular about this bill?
Thank you. Madam Chair, Committee for the Record, Jason Atkinson, State Senator from Southern Oregon. Let me just make a few brief comments regarding this bill. This is just, and I appreciate you opening them both. This bill does have respectfully a Scribner's error in its relation to Boley, and I've talked to Boley, and Boley was never my intent to be involved in this, and so there's a few amendments that take them out clearly. So you'll hear those testimonies put on the record, and I appreciate that, done. That's never the intent, but this is just another bill to get at the same issue. Let me clear up a few things by way of contrast to the testimony, just for the record. Number one, what is at stake here as a principal? We have somebody here who does not own the property, but he feels that as a member of his integrity being impugned by a city council or by a city process is saying that he's not being integral. And as you know, and I certainly stand behind this man, that he's trying to do the right thing and has been caught by a bureaucratic nightmare. And I do not like bureaucratic nightmares any more than any of you do. One of the things that we do at the state level is to drive those things out. Number two, the city has responded, but they've responded making it even more difficult. So that to me is irritating. Number three, it was put on the record that Mr. Earle tried to delay it. When Mr. Earle and his spouse have had some health issues, in which it was actually a tremendous difficulty to come here today. So let's keep that firmly in perspective. But the issue does remain: can you rent a room? It doesn't get any more complicated than that. And this particular bill seems to get at that remedy also.
Thank you, Senator. Any questions for Senator Atkinson on Senate Bill 471? I'm going to ask Sybil Hebb and Bob Estabrook to come up together, please. Yes, we do have a set of amendments here.
Madam Chair and members,
Foley was going to talk about that. Go ahead.
I'll just tell the members of the committee that you have dash ones and dash twos from the Bureau of Labor and Industries should be before you.
Thank you. And I believe that the dash twos incorporate everything that's in the dash ones. Is that correct? Well, I'll let Bob explain that. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Bob Estabrook from the Bureau of Labor and Industries. I will make my testimony very, very brief. You do have dash one and dash two amendments. The dash ones would simply eliminate section 3 of Senate Bill 471, which is a grave concern for the Bureau of Labor and Industries. We appreciate very much that Senator Atkinson worked with us to get amendments to help resolve our concerns. The dash two amendments, in addition to eliminating that section 3, would, rather than placing Senate Bill 471 into ORS 659A, which is the state civil rights statutes, we suggested that it could go into Chapter 197, which deals with land use, mostly on the grounds that Boley doesn't do land use, doesn't do permitting. We're really not experts in this sort of area and would much prefer to not be included in the bill at all. And it sounds like that is very consistent with Senator Atkinson's vision, and again, we appreciate his help in getting that cleared up. So we would urge your adoption of the dash two amendments on Senate Bill 471.
Thank you. Any questions for Bob? Sybil.
Chair Bonamici, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb for the Oregon Law Center, and we would echo the support for the dash two amendments. I think the only thing that I have to add from the Oregon Law Center's perspective is the provisions, the anti-discrimination provisions in Chapter 659A are just at the root of and very essential to our civil rights and fair housing laws in Oregon. While we are appreciative of greater options for housing and boarding houses are, we think, a viable option for low-income people, I don't think that it's the same category of circumstance as is the other set of protected classes, and so it doesn't seem appropriate to have that amendment put into Chapter 659A, but we do appreciate and are supportive of it moving forward in a zoning context. So, thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Sybil? Thank you for your testimony. And I also have Cindy Robert signed up on this. No? All right. Thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 471, and I want to thank you, Mr. Earle and Senator Atkinson, and we'll be talking. Thank you. And I want to open a public hearing on House Bill 2198, please. Committee Administrator, describe the bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2190A, or as amended, requires the insurer to provide written documentation to support evaluation when a vehicle is declared a total loss. It outlines the information to be included in that written documentation. It requires the insurer to pay an amount that's not in dispute when there is a disagreement over the value of total vehicle, and it allows the owner of a total vehicle to recover a reasonable appraisal cost from the insurer when the appraised value is greater than the insurer's final offer. There's no fiscal impact and no revenue impact. Those are before you as well. There is no conflict.
Thank you, Lori. And I also want to thank you for putting all the history, House history, in our packet regarding this bill. Teresa Miller, please. Welcome. Thank you for your patience.
Oh, no problem. Good afternoon, Chair Bonamici and members of the committee. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2190, which requires insurers to provide more information to owners of motor vehicles that have been declared a total loss or totaled, and offers greater consumer protection when insurers and vehicle owners disagree over the value of a totaled vehicle. And I want to give you just a little bit of background before I get into the specifics of the bill. Historically, the insurance division receives more complaints and inquiries about total loss issues than any other insurance-related issue. And we believe there are a couple of reasons for that. First, I think some insurers don't do an adequate job of explaining the total loss process, and in particular, the vehicle valuation process. And I think it's also just notoriously difficult to value a vehicle given all of the large number of variables that affect a vehicle's valuation. And you add to these problems the sense of urgency that consumers feel when they're facing potentially not having transportation available for a period of time while they're trying to negotiate the value of their vehicle. Under these circumstances, consumers are often at a significant disadvantage when it comes to negotiating a settlement over a totaled vehicle. So to address these issues, House Bill 2190 really does three things. First, it would increase the transparency in the total loss process, giving consumers the necessary tools that they need to make informed decisions when they're facing a total loss. It would also increase the incentives for insurers to make fair and accurate valuations and settlement offers by requiring insurers to reimburse consumers reasonable appraisal costs when a final appraisal results in a greater valuation than the insurer's final offer. And finally, it would decrease the sense of urgency felt by consumers by requiring insurers to pay the undisputed amount of the vehicle's value while negotiations continue. So, for example, if an insurer values a vehicle at $5,000, but the consumer values that vehicle at $7,000, the insurer would pay the $5,000 up front while negotiations continue. House Bill 2190 increases the transparency of the total loss process by requiring insurers to provide vehicle owners, written explanations of the methods used to determine the value of total vehicles. What we're looking at is really an easy one-pager, easy-to-read explanation to consumers that describes issues that we get calls about all the time, issues like what is a total loss, what happens if consumers and insurers disagree over the value of a vehicle, just basic information for consumers to help them as they navigate through the total loss process. 2190 also increases the incentive for insurers to make fair and accurate vehicle valuations and settlement offers. When an insurance policy has a provision for resolving valuation disputes through appraisal, and they're not required to contain such a provision, but when they do, the bill requires insurers to reimburse consumers for reasonable appraisal costs when that final appraisal decision is greater than the insurer's final offer. And finally, House Bill 2190 decreases the sense of urgency frequently felt by consumers faced with a totaled vehicle by requiring insurers to pay that undisputed amount up front, allowing the consumer to continue to negotiate the balance of the claim. After three public hearings in the House Consumer Protection Committee, House Bill 2190 passed the House of Representatives in a 50-9 vote. And with that, I appreciate the opportunity to be here, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. I have a couple. I wanted to ask you if you have determined the approximate cost of an appraisal.
Madam Chair, as far as the approximate cost of the appraisal, I think based on some of the conversations folks in our division have had with appraisers, my understanding is they cost a couple of $100s, but I'm not an expert on the cost of appraisals, so...
Thank you. Mm-hmm. My second question is, House Bill 2190A requires that the insurers pay the undisputed amount up front while the negotiations continue, and I understand the reason for that, because if the car is totaled, the insurer doesn't have a way to get around and they want to work on trying to find a replacement and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a sort of common understanding, I think, among people that when you get a check from an insurance company, when you endorse that check, then you're done. So can you tell me what parameters are in the bill to make sure that negotiation can continue rather than that endorsement constituting an acceptance of the or a final offer?
Yes, Madam Chair, I'm looking for the language in the bill.
Section 3, is that right? Is that true? Acceptance of payments, line 19 or 20.
Thank you. Madam Chair, line 19 on page 1, it looks like. Acceptance of payment of the undisputed amount neither waives the rights of the insured or third-party owner under the policy nor prevents the insured or third-party owner from pursuing a claim for additional amounts.
Thank you very much. Just wanted
to get
that on the
record. Sorry, I didn't have that right at the
time. That's all right. Questions? No. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
John Powell, please. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, my name is John Powell, representing State Farm Insurance Companies. Madam Chair, we've worked this bill with the division through the interim in two or three meetings, and we're participants in the House, and we agree with the provisions minus one, and that has to do with the advance payment. We agree, and it is best practices in the insurance industry to advance the undisputed amount for the first party, your insured, because you have a contractual obligation with them. Our concern with advancing payments to a third party is the effect that has on our contractual obligation to defend our insured. And it simply puts us in a different situation in settling a claim. We have an obligation to our insured to try to settle that claim within policy limits so that they don't have to dig into their pockets and that sort of thing. And anytime you prepay, there's less money than in a final settlement. So we have that concern, and I would simply leave with the committee a copy of a case. This case didn't make it all the way through the appellate courts. This is a Court of Appeals case that Justice Gillette, then on the Court of Appeals, now on the Supreme Court, authored. It talks about this issue in general. And then the case was later thrown out because of a statute of limitations issue. But it is instructive, somewhat instructive. And I would simply, say that a few phone calls to practicing attorneys in this area to get some feedback, because it is starting down a road that, again, we would not advise involving prepayments in our tort system the way it currently operates.
Mr. Powell, could you give us an example of a third-party situation where you said it might interfere with your relationship with the insured? If you could just tell us, like, a scenario of how that would happen and where the problem would be.
Madam Chair, young driver has minimum limits of $10,000 in property damage, and they cause an accident that destroys one or multiple other automobiles, and they're totaled. There's all kinds of issues involved, including potential comparative negligence, all kinds of things that where facts would be ferreted out. And once liability is clear, the insurer has an obligation to go ahead and make an offer to settle that in a timely manner. It could be that by starting to dispense this money, you're going to run out of policy limits money. And it's possible in that case for the insurer then to dispense that money and leave their insured person to deal with the rest of the issues. And we think the current system would require us
to work with that person and the claimants and do our best to keep them within policy limits if that's possible. Sometimes that's just not going to be possible. And sometimes if the person does not have other resources, the parties will negotiate in those situations. So we just think that this is kind of a slippery slope. In many cases, a party that's hit like that can take their car to their own insurance company. But fully 12% of the people in Oregon have no insurance at all. And then in addition to that, there's a lot of people that do not carry physical damage insurance on their car, so they can't go to their own insurance company in a case like that. So those are the types of cases that we would be concerned about.
My concern is that this doesn't change the policy limit. I mean, the policy limit stays the same regardless of what it says in House Bill 2190. So,
Madam Chair, that's correct. It's just in a case where you're going to exhaust the policy limit or come close to exhausting the policy limit, depending on the agreement you make.
Any questions for Mr. Powell? No. Thank you very much for your testimony.
I'll just leave this.
And thank you very much. I'll make sure that both Senator Girard and Senator George read the case. And I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2190A, and I've been asked to hold off on a work session in the absence of at least a couple of my committee members. So we will be rescheduling this at a later date. So I'm going to close the committee for today, and we are adjourned. Thank you.